Should we episode 30?
We're episode 30.
Fuck me.
We are entering middle age.
Oh, wow.
we can't drink as much anymore.
No. All right.
Actually, it's funny. I was at brunch this morning before we came here, and there was this table of two girls and two boys in their early 20s, maybe mid-20s at the latest, and one of the girls says, oh, I'm so weak. I only had about four or five drinks last night, and I'm really hungover. And her friend says, yeah, we're getting old. So I'm sitting there drinking my chai latte going, wow, I had two wines and I'm feeling seedy. Welcome to 39. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and sitting beside me is your co-host, Ian Mond, and this is episode 30.
It's amazing.
I know.
30 episodes of this drivel. It is astonishing.
We need to start going to bed early. Have to stop all the drinking and the partying, clearly.
Yeah.
We're a more mature podcast.
Do you think we can hit 50?
50 now seems a lot more doable than 100 did when we started and you said you wanted to do 100.
Well, like, that's what I still want to do. No, we can
that's
do
That's a long time.
Another 70 podcasts. It's only
Your
6
kids will be both in school.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Which gives me more time. We could probably go weekly.
Oh, never mind about that.
What, going weekly or my kids being in school?
Possibly both.
Well, you see, if you didn't keep bailing out of podcasts,
I don't bail.
What about October? What about October?
October, I'm going to be in the UK for a whole month. So, no, I'm not going to Skype a podcast in at some stage.
I don't actually have much to say. I mean, I know it's been a long time.
It's been fairly long because we did the June podcast fairly early in the month because it was recorded at Continuum.
Yes.
And now it's very near the end of July. So it has been about a six. By the time I get this edited and online, maybe close to 7 weeks.
Yeah, and people aren't even emailing or SMSing or – no one SMSs. Tweeting. People aren't even tweeting us to say, where's the new podcast?
They don't care anymore.
They've given up. They've essentially given up.
They have.
And I don't blame them. But still, 30 episodes.
Maybe they didn't care about the books we're talking about this week.
Well, they should care about at least one of them.
Ooh.
I wonder which one that'll be. I won't give away a spoiler.
You recommended the other one.
Yeah, I did. You spoiled it. No, I there's a reason I recommended it.
Okay, I'm looking forward to hearing that.
Yes.
Shall we get straight into the books?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go.
All right. Well, I recommended a short story collection called Hairside, Fleshside by Canadian writer Helen Marshall, which I really, really love. It came my way via the Bram Stoker Awards. And, yeah, it's awesome.
So you don't have a subscription with Cheezing? Because I get their e-books monthly. And they produce some amazing stuff.
I'm scared of e-book subscriptions.
That would be silly.
No, that would just be another pile of forgotten books on my tablet.
Yes.
I forget what books are there.
Yes.
Seriously, when I read this one, because I did have this one as an ebook, I'm going, oh, there's also that.
Yes. I have no idea what's on my Kindle
it's
app
terrible.
Anymore. I literally do not have
the
any idea.
The books are not read and they're not staring at me from my To Be Read shelf, so I don't remember that. What I'm thinking of doing is actually printing out little like thumbnail-sized covers of the books and sticking them up on the end of my bookshelf.
That's crazy talk.
No, that's crazy talk. Then they're going to look at me every time I go up to the bookshelf. And when I've read them, I can pull them off.
No, it's crazy talk.
Why? How else am I going to keep track of all my unread e-books?
Well, no, you're right. The way I do it is by not doing it, is by someone reviewing something that I vaguely remember I might have and being interested in the review and going, oh, I probably should read that. Except I'm not even doing that now. I mean, there are seriously books on my Kindle that I will never, ever look at. That are literally collecting digital dust as we speak.
This was I know.
This was one of them, actually. Sorry, Helen, until you recommended it, because I already had it.
Well, see, there you go. And this is why. It's like,
that's why I do the podcast.
Yeah, well.
Because you recommend things that I already own that I haven't read.
I think that's happened for next
including
month,
including
too,
yeah, next month is
yeah,
the same.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah. Okay, anyway, so back, brief diversion about scariness of
and just to put my story in, fellow friend of the podcast, Roberto Shearman, you may know of him,
yes,
also my man love person, has spoken very highly of Helen.
Well, he wrote. Did you read the introduction?
I did.
It's a really good introduction.
It was all right. He's written better.
Oh,
it was the weakest part of the book.
I think Helen will be glad to hear that.
Yes, so Rob's spoken very highly of her, and, you know, that. So I was already preparing to read the collection, then forgot about it. Then you reminded me via the podcast. So here we are.
Full circle.
I know, it's amazing. It's amazing how that works.
It's interesting that Rob Shearman has written the introduction, because her style reminds me very much of his.
You think so?
I do. And I don't know whether that's because he wrote the introduction, so therefore he was in my mind as I'm reading the book, or if I would have made that connection anyway. But, yeah, she's got this really beautiful storytelling voice, and it's really light and graceful in tone, even though some of the stories get really, you know, horrible. And Rob Shearman's the same. He's got this really distinctive storytelling voice. And his prose work is really light. It's really easy to read. It's graceful. And also some of his stories take you to really strange places.
And they give you that both of them give you that uncomfortable feeling, because they're set in the real our world, I suppose. But it's not like the old Stephen King thing. Oh, you set something in the real world and make something horrible happen, a fantasy like thing happen, which takes you out of that comfort zone. These stories already start and you're feeling uncomfortable from the first, which is very hard to capture in the first few paragraphs of a story. And yet it's just the words that are used.
Yeah, no, she's not wasting any time on sort of unnecessary setup.
And these are 15, is that right?
They're 15. Yeah. And they're laid out like an angel, which I thought was really nice.
Are they?
The body parts mentioned.
Are they really? I missed that bit. Pick all these little bits.
No, they're right there. If you open the table of contents, and
which I did,
they're above every story as well. Like every story has a title, but above that title is a picture and there's a word.
But why do you say angel, though?
Because they're all human. Well, I mean, the fingernail and stomach, heart, hand.
But again, why are you saying angel?
Well, there's wing. There's one in there that's not human, and that word is wing.
So is that what you think that's an angel?
It's a human being with wings.
Yeah, it could be a winged human. Let's talk about the stories before I make more
about this.
No, let's talk about the stories before I make
myself.
I think
it's this nice thing. You can kind of picture the book because it's this body of an angel.
Can you talk about Blessed? Spread out. Which is the first story in the collection.
Can I talk about Blessed? Blessed is a wonderful beginning.
Do you think it was a good start? Do you think that's the way you would have gone if you were putting this collection together? Does it set the tone?
It sets the tone beautifully. I mean, I think there's any number of stories that you could open with. It's not my favourite in the collection, but it's really good. And I think it definitely sets the tone. The young girl, it's her birthday in this world, because it's our world, young girls on their seventh birthday,
yep.
Get given, which is, you know, the holy number, so that's nice. So there's lots of, like, I think it's an angel. I think the story.
Okay, it's an angel. All right.
They get given parts of a saint.
Yes,
it's their seventh birthday present, and the saint will actually manifest as a ghost.
Yeah, and stay with you,
and that's why you know it's a real.
Yep.
Body part of the saint. The theme of the story, which is love and what you do for love and what you put up with for love. And her work's very, I was going to say very unique, and then I'd have to hit myself.
Why? You can hit yourself.
You can't qualify unique.
What?
Can't qualify unique. It's an absolute. Something's unique or it's not. It's not very unique or kind of unique.
Oh, my God. I fucked English again. I do that all the time. Always going on with how things are very unique. Joshy should be taken from me.
Don't qualify unique.
My son should be taken from me. Anyway, yes. So anyway. They're not unique. They're what?
They are unique.
Yes. Okay.
Like she has a distinctive unique voice.
I think it is a great start to the collection because it does tell you what you're in for.
It is. And
not every story is like that. And there are some that are all about tone and taste rather than being a linear narrative.
Yep,
they're more an amuse-bouche of a story rather than
like that.
A meal. and so what I'm saying is that they're not all blessed, but
not all of them have a really strong narrative.
Correct.
Arc. Yeah.
Correct. And that's what I loved about it, that variety. So you're not just going from one narrative to another. You are getting that tonal difference, that real change in voice.
Blessed has a very Blessed is a story. It's it's a nice beginning, middle, end kind of story, and it's really sad and there's the vein of cruelty that runs through that story is quite disturbing.
Yeah, but so is the vein of cruelty that runs through Sandition.
I think maybe it's more disturbing in Blessed because we're talking about a seven-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And the like, because she's her parents who are divorced and have the father has a new partner, a new wife actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a whole jealousy so thing between the two.
The daughter is being used as a pawn, sort of in with and, their own sort of.
And it's a secret
battles.
That she's got the relic for Lucia
because the father and which is there's a beautiful. Way she uses the words that she's right in the middle of the little girl's head because her father and his new wife, when she's with them, they're her mum and dad, and her biological mother is her other mum. And when she's with her biological mother, her dad's wife is her other mother. Like yep. There's this beautiful switch, like depending on which home she's in, she refers to her two mothers as other. It's really beautiful. And that tiny little detail of prose work, you get this whole tension between the families because she calls her dad's new wife mum. Like she doesn't call her by her first name or anything like that. So it's this wonderful little encapsulation of the tension between, you know, the her biological parents and yeah, a really nice sort of explanation without explaining anything of how her biological mother feels. Having the other mother,
yeah, there.
And you know her father is more well off than her mother. So I mean, there might be a dual income family. They've obviously got more money. They can give her something a lot better,
yeah,
than her mother could ordinarily have given
and
her.
And therefore, there's that jealousy and that tension. And you're right. There's that element of cruelty to it.
Yeah.
But to go back to what you're saying, the subtlety in the writing. It doesn't feel like, and this is going to sound extremely patronising, but it doesn't feel like someone who's, this is their debut collection. It feels like someone who's been doing this for 20, 30 years.
Well, she's been writing for about, for a long, I mean, she's a medieval scholar. She's a poet. Her poetry collection won an award recently.
The poetry probably helps, doesn't it, to get that sort of very subtle.
Well, I think when you write poetry, you're, like every word, like every word always counts. But actually, it doesn't when you're writing prose. You know, there's a lot of words which don't count. Like when you're writing a poem, every word counts so precisely
because of the meter and the tone.
Because you have so few, like you've got to make
What do you mean you have few?
Well, you're writing a poem. A poem isn't a short story.
There are prose poems.
Yeah, but I mean. Yeah, unless you're writing epic poetry, you don't have the space. You don't have the
okay.
You can't. It's like look, it's like a short story is more pared down than a novel's going to be. You've got more space in a novel to put in things which might be extraneous, but are nice. You know, you might put them in for texture or whatever. But in a short story, you can't really do that. You've got to crunch it down. In a poem, you have to crunch it down even further. You've got this limited space, so every word you choose kind of has to do double and triple duty. And good poets know this, and that's how.
Well, she does that in her prose.
And she does it in her prose.
Yeah,
she's
okay.
Very careful with her words and
so in other words, I was being patronising and I should have taken into account her poetry background.
Well, no. I mean, I think it is an astonishing first collection. It's and often with a first collection or a first novel, you can give a little slack.
Well, it's just I go back to – and I keep coming back to this.
But you don't need to at this
point. On Coode Street when Jonathan and Gary were talking about – this is well over a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, talking about first collections and how there's this urge from authors to get that first collection out. And so they will throw in – and they may only have 15 stories that they've actually written and they will vary in quality. And there might be five or six that are genuinely good and that's actually what's made people notice them, but the other eight or nine are not very good, and that's what ruins that first collection. And yet with Helen here, and again, I didn't check the publishing history of each of these stories, how many are original to this and how many have been published elsewhere. I didn't bother to look. But there's no feel here that there isn't a single dud here. There isn't a single dud story in this collection, and it's been – and whether it was Helen's choice or with her editor, the way it's been put together also feels that there's a plan to it. It's not just, well, here's a bunch of stories I've written. I want to get my first collection out and I'll just throw them into a pot and publish it. So, I apologise for the patronising thing. But it's just to come up with a collection that is this assured to start off with is not an easy thing to do, given how many are out there.
Yeah, well, you're right. There's only one story in here, which is the Lovecraft one that's been previously published. Texture Like Velvet. Texture. Yeah.
Okay, so they're all original to the collection.
Yeah, and I think that's, that's the difference. It's like when we talked about Lisa Hannett's debut collection.
Another Assured.
Yeah, Bluegrass Symphony. And, yeah. And I mean, there is a difference between writing work over a period of time and publishing and then collecting the stories you have and putting them together in a book. And that's one way of producing a collection and a debut collection. And actually writing a collection of stories.
The first way is what I've always been used to, Stephen King, come on down. but it's not just him. It's what I never knew. In fact, it wasn't – I don't mean to mention him again. It wasn't until Robert Sherman came along with Tiny Deaths that I became aware of this idea that you could actually just write an original bunch of short stories that had never seen the light of day anywhere and put them together thematically into a collection. People do that with novels. They're a mosaic novels, I know that, but they're not really short story collections.
No.
Whereas Tiny Deaths is a genuine short story collection.
And so is Bluegrass Symphony.
So is this a new phenomenon?
I think it depends what kind of a writer you are. If you're a novelist who occasionally puts short stories out, then that's the way you're going to collect your short stories. If you're a short story writer, you've got two avenues to do it. You can either write a collection and publish it, or you can publish as you go. I mean, Kelly Link's collections are almost there's usually a couple of new stories in there, but they've almost always been previously published work, I believe.
Yeah, but that's because of the practicalities of the industry that they're working in. I mean, unless you've got a job, a full-time job, and you're actually earning. I mean, Harlan Ellison.
Well, you're not going to be making money off your short stories anyway.
Well,
these days.
But someone like a Harlan Ellison was churning them out. High quality stories were churning them out, and I don't know if you made a living. I think he did.
Oh yeah, look. But short story, you could make a living. Short story rates haven't changed much in several decades. So
that's disgraceful, isn't it?
Yeah. So 50 years ago, you could actually make a living writing and publishing a short story a week, and you'd make a living. You'd make a living wage.
But then the phenomenon of inflation took control, and
somehow no one ever told the editors. Yeah. That's not
but that's for probably another podcast. You know, maybe something that Jonathan can talk about on Coot Street.
I mean, there's at the high end, you will still get paid thousands of dollars to write a short story. So if you publish in the New Yorker, if you publish in the high end glossy magazines, usually towards the literary end of it, not so much the spec fic genre end, you will still get paid thousands of dollars.
But essentially,
whether you can publish one of those every week, unlikely.
No, of course. But essentially, Helen, getting back to Helen,
yes,
she's been able to craft her collection.
Yeah, and I think it makes a difference because she's writing the stories knowing that they're going to fit together. And that can be the difference. I mean, when you have someone like Kelly Link, who again is another writer with this amazing, unique voice that's her own. I mean, that's a Kelly Link story is a Kelly Link story. So her collections just all hold together because they're unified by the voice of her stories. So it doesn't matter that the stories haven't been written to fit together as a whole explicitly, I think.
Yeah, okay.
But you have other writers who write very differently and very broadly and lots of, you know, disparate sort of subject matters and tones and voices. And when they're all put together, they're like a best of and they're great, but they may not feel like a cohesive work in themselves.
Okay,
they are a collection of...
So maybe that's why... Okay, and this doesn't make the task any easier, but that's why it feels cohesive. It's not... Obviously, it's not a mosaic novel. Yes, there's all the buddy part allusions and things like that. And if we want,
well, they were grafted on afterwards. She didn't.
Well, how do we know?
I heard an interview with her.
Oh, well, that's unfair. You've done research.
Oh, heaven forfend.
I mean, you can see I've done bugger all. In fact, I didn't know 14 of the stories were original to
I came across a really cool interview on YouTube with her, just a couple of – it's only a very short interview. We'll link to it in the show notes. But, yeah, she did have the idea of making this body, making the book a sort of –
Did she mention angels in that interview?
No, she didn't actually mention angel.
She did, didn't
In fact,
she?
The person interviewing her was talking about how they were animal parts. I thought, they're not animal parts. The only part that
was – What
was
Helen's response to the animal parts? Did she just know?
Oh, no.
Did she wink at you through YouTube and go, Kirsten's figured it out. It's angel, not animals.
Well, I think it's because the only thing there which couldn't be human is the wing. I mean, you could do it the other way. Maybe you could say the only thing there which couldn't belong to a bird is a fingernail. So it's a bird with really long fingernails. And it depends how you interpret it, I guess. But if you look at it, because she's a medievalist, so and most of there's such a physicality about so many of her stories. So I think the body thing and the angel thing, it works really well. But anyway, what was I saying about her interview? Oh, yeah, so she grafted them on. It's not as though she picked a body part and wrote a story.
I love how you've used the word grafted.
Oh, huh.
That is just...
I did not mean to. No pun intended. Fantastic. Yes, so, and she spoke to the fact that there were some stories in there. It was really hard to identify a body part that would be appropriate. And some of them are quite oblique.
I'll be honest, I didn't give a shit about the whole body part thing.
You didn't even notice, did you?
No, I did notice it. That's just wrong of you to be like, you're just rude. No, it's not that. It's just that I read them to read the stories.
I don't think you need to notice. They don't form like a key or anything. They're a nice embellishment. Okay. But they're not something that's
Should we speak about some of the other stories?
Yes, let's.
We don't have to go through all of them because there's 15 of them.
What was your favourite in the collection?
It's a toss-up between Sandition and is it Dead White Guys?
Oh, Dead White Guys, yes. Dead White Men.
Dead White Men. Yep. It's a toss-up between those two. Mm-hmm. Sandition is – I've never read anything like Sandition.
I loved Sandition.
It's
– Tell people what Sandition is about.
I don't want to give too much of that one away because I really want people to enjoy it. But a woman, an editor.
Yep.
She's an editor. She's out there trying to get the next novel of this new writer. They go out for drinks or some such, and when she's in the toilet having a break during their sort of date, business meeting, whatever you want to call it, she notices...
It was definitely a date.
It was a... Well, I don't know about
it
that.
It wasn't a business meeting.
Well, I think it was intended... Well, anyway, I can't remember which part... Oh, I suppose that if I looked at the body part bit, it'd probably tell me... Well, skin. no, it's veins. Actually, Sandition is veins. You would think skin would be... Mm. Anyway, she finds that... she's not sure what's going on.
She finds a mark on the back of her neck. A sort of raised, scabby bit of skin. And her first thought is that it's cancer of some kind.
Yeah. I've told Jonathan a number of times, I'm really shit at summarizing stories. Really bad. But the guy who she's courting, who's also this author discovers when you peel away enough of her skin that actually what you've got there is the long-lost new novel of Austen.
Yeah, the last novel that she was writing when she died.
Yes, before she died. And that, of course, novel is Sandition.
Yes.
So, in a sense, Jane Austen is written on the skin of this woman.
Inside her, though. She's behind
the skin of this woman,
yeah,
yes.
Like, it's not on her skin. She peels the bit off that she finds and then there's just a hole in her. She's hollow inside.
Yes.
Like, she's just hollow.
Yes.
There's just that beautiful bit because she ends up getting a torch and shining
it. Don't spoil too much
of
this one.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we've spoiled it, right? That's the concept.
Yeah.
But we're not spoiled it because it's how the story's told. I mean, this is the other thing. You could reread this a dozen times and get different things out of it. They're such beautiful layered stories.
Quite funny you saying that about this particular one because she is essentially an onion.
But that's the thing. So she shines a light and there's that beautiful description of the text written inside her body and the implication is that she's just hollow inside and the text is written on the inside of her but she's hollow. It's beautiful. It's so beautiful.
But cruel because she's being abused and used, stuck up in a hotel room, told not to leave because this author has realised that he can make a quick buck.
Yes.
Saying that he has access to...
Austen's last novel.
Austen's last novel.
Yeah, so they're photographing and transcribing the inside of her to access the novel. It's a beautiful story. It's written really well. And what's her name? Oh, Hannah. Yeah, so Hannah is beautifully written. There's this one line I really... Because the author is married, right? So he's having an affair with the editor, which she instigates, kind of. I mean,
but she's been told to do whatever she can to get this guy's new novel as well.
That's
the start of the story.
That's the start of the story. But that's not why she sleeps with him. But there's this wonderful line because they have an affair like one night in a hotel at this conference and then she finds the thing on her neck and she gets really worried about it and asks him to come and have a look at it and she gets sort of angry at him. And then there's this beautiful line that says, she could see his face again in the mirror and he was looking at her, face a bit tense as if he could feel their relationship growing strange, growing real. And that is just this most wonderful description of this one-night fling that they're kind of both having. And then, actually, no, it's no, it's a bit serious, and then it's not fun, and then, you know, it's, but she's got this beautiful way of phrasing things that make you sort of step back and really think about what she's talking about. I mean, there could be any way she could have written that, but that's that last line about the relationship growing real that's just beautiful.
It is. And then there's Dead White...
Dead White Men.
Men.
It's men, isn't it? It is Dead White Men.
But I like Dead White Guys. Can she change it for me? Can you describe Dead White Guys? Because I can do it, but and it's the second last story, and it just
before we do, don't you love the ending of Sedition 2? I'm not going to say what it is, but yes, the ending.
It's very, very powerful.
The ending is fantastic.
And it's a sort of story.
Because you wonder where it's going
to
go.
I was about to say that. Because you think it's a great concept, great idea, but how do you end this fucker?
Where's she going to go?
How do you end it?
The most beautiful, beautiful ending.
If I have one criticism about this whole collection, I'm not entirely convinced about some of the endings of the stories. But endings are bloody hard with short fiction at the best of times.
I think some of the endings are quite minimalist. They just sort of leave off, like they leave. It's like you're drifting in and out of something that's happening, which I don't mind. I quite like that sort of a story. I don't necessarily need a really strong narrative thread to finish on. I'm quite happy with a story that takes me to a place and shows me something and then says, now go away and think about it, which is what I think quite a few of her stories in here do. So going back to Dead White Men. Okay, so this is a story about a woman who is completely in love with the dead white men of literature. So the sort of derogatory phrase that's used to talk about the idea of canon and how it was populated with dead white men for most of the time, right? Very few women getting a look in, very few different voices, it's all stories of dead white men, self-explanatory. But she's in love with these great poets and writers, and she meets a young man in a bar, and we get the impression that he's not the first person that she's done with this, but he seems to be particularly conducive,
yep.
Shall we say? So she keeps doing it with him, because what she does is she'll take him somewhere to a location where a dead white man is buried, and she'll have sex with him, but she will channel the dead white man through him.
Yep.
So he in the beginning actually doesn't, like, it's sort of a blank, that part, and then he comes back to himself and it's all over, and that's what she's done. She's channeled the ghost of I can't remember who all they are.
Wasn't Blake one of them at one point?
Yeah, I think so, and Chaucer, or was he actually, was Chaucer in the other story? But anyway, and that's what she does. And I don't know if we should give away the ending, because it's more
another story where you go, great concept, we're going to take this. And what's surprising about it is that it becomes a story about him, not about her. And his development as a person, his journey. So he could easily have just been fodder for the story, you know.
Because it is his story. I mean, it is told from his
point
of view.
It could easily have been a story about his creepy obsession with this woman.
Yeah. But
it isn't,
because something happens which makes her go, okay, this isn't working anymore, and she breaks off all contact.
Yes.
And she does, and he goes, okay. He doesn't, like, yeah, you're saying, yeah, the story could have gone where him continuing to
pursue her. And just become this weird, creepy story about a guy who loves her but can't get through to her because she just wants to fuck dead white men.
And that's it. And that's sort of the tragic note that's in the middle of the beginning of this story, is that he falls in love with her.
Yeah, but then he
doesn't love him.
He goes through this massive character development, and it is just amazing. It just takes the story in a – oh, I was making love to this story.
The ending is beautiful.
The ending – that was the story that had me in tears. That ending is just spot on.
Yeah.
Note perfect.
Yeah.
If you're not convinced by the first 25 minutes of our rambling, buy it just for that story, because it is, in fact, and that was
actually
one,
no, I don't. I think it's a really good story.
It was my. It's Sandition I loved, but that probably is my favorite. It upsets me. There's so many short stories out there. We know that. Okay,
yep.
There is a lot of short fiction out there, but it does upset me when I come across a story like that after award ballots are in, and that I realize, you know what, that would have been probably my top story, because I think this is 2012. This is
2012. Yep,
that would have probably been one of my top, if not top, stories of the year. That story.
Yeah,
that's how damn good it is. And yet, it's not going to get it'll get noticed because we're talking about it now, and there are reviews of the book on the web. We'll talk about one of those reviews in a second. But and look, the collection will always be there. But you sort of, I know you, Kirsten, don't write just to get awards, but I there is this urge to say to people, look, I want all of you to love it. I want this to get as wide recognition as possible and for it to have awards and be nominated 500 times and that sort of thing.
But because it's more than – it's because
I fall in love with it. I fall in love with the words, with the story. And Sandition was the same. Sandition is another story that if I'd known about it in 2012, I would have thrown it on a ballot.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, as I said, I came across this because of the Bram Stoker Awards. It wasn't a category I was judging, but if you're a HWA member, you get access to works that are published. People sort of put them out there and because, you know, they're putting them out there to hopefully get nominated. Yeah. So Helen posted and said, I've got this collection, and I think I'd heard it mentioned on Galactic Suburbia as well. So I put my hand up and said, yeah, sure, I'll have a look at it. And yeah, oh, it's fantastic. And I'm really sad that it didn't get a Stoker nomination. I'm really, really sad about that. I think
you were judging the wrong category.
No, the Stokers are, it's an odd judging. I think World Fantasy has started this as well, where half the ballot is determined by a judging panel and half the ballot is determined by membership. So it's not necessarily what the judge is like as going to, I mean, what the judge is like will get onto a ballot. They don't have any say in who actually wins anyway. Yep. But yeah, if I'd been judging a short fiction or collections, I would have fought tooth and nail to get something of Helen Marshall's on a ballot. Just for the recognition. I mean, the awards themselves are lovely, but getting on the ballot is – it's something that's there. Like, the book will always be there, but how do people find it? But something that's on an awards ballot, it's a list that's there for years to come that people might go back and look at and look at things that were published in previous years and get reading lists
that's
out
right.
of. Otherwise, it's just a book that's out there in the ether.
I think Helen's too good to be forgotten. This won't be it. She'll do plenty more and she will.
She's working on another short story collection, and when she finishes, because she's also she's also working on a PhD in manuscript study. She's a medievalist. So she takes a break from that to write these. These are a holiday.
Yeah, pretty dark and disturbing holiday. I just want to say that those aren't the only two good stories.
No. I think my favourite, it's really hard. I love Sandition. I do like Dead White Men. I do think it's the story with the most familiar sort of rhythms.
You know what's another corker? The one about Brazil.
Yeah.
In the high places of the world.
I like that. I didn't love that.
No, that's a great story. You're wrong. With the architecture guy.
I think they're all great stories, but okay. I think it's how it's which ones speak to you. And I think as much as I really did like Sandition and
the one with the statue,
I really liked. That was an odd story.
Yeah, but I really liked that one too.
Yeah.
But you can't keep saying.
I really like them. What can I get to my favorite?
Yes, all right.
I think my favorite probably would have to be The Art of Dying, which I just loved.
That is a gorgeous story, yes.
I just loved and yes. I was almost in, like I was in pre-tears by the end of it.
Pre-tears?
Yeah, yeah.
Not actual tears?
Well, I don't like crying when I read.
I had a real...
But yes. It's an amazing story and it's about a woman who has died. And she comes back in the bodies of other women who are about to die to help them die because she's good at it. And they're not women who are about to kill themselves or anything. They're just going to die in an accident, in something. Yeah. And she knows when they're going to die. I don't know if it's ever quite clear that she knows how. I don't know that's made explicit. But she knows when. And the implication is that it's an accidental death. It's not like they're about to commit suicide or she's going to make them kill themselves.
But she's tying up their lives.
She's tying up their – she's making it easier for the people who will be left behind. So she packs up their belongings. She pays bills. She tidies up their life and she – and there's a communication between them. It's not that they don't know she's in their head. There is a communication. And it's this amazing story because Clarissa, who's the woman who's inhabiting – these other people who are about to die, is snatching for herself bits of life along the way. And it's just wonderful. It's all these tangled lives and, yeah, the ending is killer. The ending is, oh, yeah, tears. It is a great
story.
Not
just pre-tears, real tears.
I think tears, yeah. No, it's a great story. It's possibly my favourite. I don't necessarily think it's – you know, the most accomplished or in the collection or the most clever or anything like that, but it's the one that got me emotionally. And I think that's possibly the key to this. Like, these stories, they're dealing with human emotion and interaction and desires and dreams and longings and the past and all of that. And so they're going to, I think, connect with different readers in different ways, because everyone's going to have a different sort of emotional canvas that they bring to the story.
Yep.
And so each story will latch onto a different reader, which, you know, I mean, you loved In the High Places of the World, and I really liked it. It's a really good story, but it didn't grab me emotionally the way The Art of Dying or Blessed did.
Yeah, fair point.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, like, I think my favourite, in this collection anyway, my favourite comes from a really emotional place rather than, you know, that this story is so amazingly clever and so on, which most of them are. Most of them are extremely clever.
Can I quote Nina Allen's last paragraph of her Strange Horizon review, because I think it's a good...
Please do, and I will link to the whole review in the show notes.
Okay, you do that. Nina Allen said, she says, sometimes a book comes along that is so original, so vibrantly alive, so beautifully imagined, and so much a lore unto itself, that the only comment or advice a reviewer can offer is to say, go read it. Hairside, Fleshside is one such book, and having experienced it, I'm left with a genuine sense of excitement thinking about where Helen Marshall might take us next. I couldn't agree more.
No, neither could I. I think part of the excitement is that with these stories, and you'd imagine, I need to go back actually to find her book of poetry, because I'm really keen to read her poetry. It's called The Skeleton Key, I think. Anyway, I think part of the excitement is you don't know with any of these stories exactly where they're going to go.
No, you just don't know. Idea.
And yet the stories end, for the most part, in a really satisfying way.
Yep.
So you didn't know where they were going to go. They ended up in a place that was mostly unexpected or strange, but still really satisfying. So they're the best writers to read. They're not predictable. They're not like, oh, yes, I know what I'm going to get with say, a Stephen King book.
Yeah.
Which, like, I love Stephen King, and I read his new crime novel.
Joyland,
yeah, just recently. And it's really good. But, you know, there's rhythms, there's a familiarity, there's a comfort to it. And that's a pleasure of reading that I do enjoy. But then there's another one where you're just taking an author's hand who you trust just to do a really good job. No idea what they're going to do,
yeah,
but it's going to be great. So you'll go with them. And they're probably my favourite kind of writers, to be honest.
And Helen's up there now.
Oh, Helen is up there now.
Okay, well, so that's Hairside, Fleshside. Yeah. Obviously, we both recommend it.
Oh, totally, totally. I think...
Go buy it from Cheezine. It's an e-book, and I think also it is a hard copy book as well, so you can...
I have an e-copy. I'm actually going to buy a hard copy because this is a book that I actually want on my shelf and not lost
you
on my
tablet.
You and
Helen just become best friends.
I'm really sure I'm not the only person who's loved her book.
No, Nina Allen loved it too. And me. There's three. No, there's been more than that. The next book we're talking about is the one that I chose, but as I said at the end of the last podcast... I broke the rules a bit because I'm not choosing it necessarily because I thought it was the greatest novel of all time. I think it's a very interesting book.
You'd be the
book.
Only one, apparently.
I think it's a very interesting – well, I think it's a very interesting book. It's a book that in 2002 and post-2002 has garnered much respect, love. You know, it's very highly thought of. That is Light by M. John Harrison.
And it's the first of a trilogy.
A trilogy, which listening to him – talk to Gary and Jonathan on Coote Street, you get the feeling that, well, it's not a feeling, it's clear that it's really one large book. So Nova Swing and Empty Spaces isn't a trilogy as much as one. It's not even a complete story because they don't follow each other in a narrative sense, but tonally and thematically, etc., it's one complete package.
Don't you say that about any trilogy then?
No, well...
I mean, really, though, unless...
No, but I think the idea is that he could have published all three in one volume rather than as three distinct books.
But again, can't you say that about any... I mean, it might be a big volume, but can't you say that about any trilogy?
No, because I think there are some trilogies that genuinely are meant to have breakpoints.
Hmm. Well, but I mean, as I haven't read the other two, but I've read some reviews of them, and it seems that the stories are really different, characters are really different.
Well, the second one, definitely.
So aren't they very distinct breakpoints?
Okay. I'm just repeating what M. John Harrison said. Well, the only reason I raise that is because a number of the issues we may have with this book, I can see some people saying, yes, but if you read Empty Spaces, those concerns are alleviated or they're not issues, you know, if you read Nova Swing. which is all well and good.
Well, you kind of got to get to those two, though, don't you?
Yes.
And if you,
but people were quite happy to review this in 2002 without those two books. It's not like everyone went, well.
And was it clear when this was released that it was book one of?
I think there isn't. But I do remember that. Yes, he was doing, because I think Nova Swing's already close to coming out. There was talk about Nova Swing. So,
but unless you knew that, like unless you're actually reading blogs and things, like someone going into a bookshop who likes science fiction but doesn't, you know, read everyone's blogs and things and find out stuff, wouldn't know from picking up Light off the shelf that this is.
Oh no! There is no indication at all that,
and
it's
even
part
by
of
finishing
sort of
it, you wouldn't be thinking, oh, this, and in fact, there must be a second book because this isn't finished.
But you could pick up Nova Swing without even picking up Light and not know that Nova Swing was the second book in the series. So,
see, I'm thinking the whole one combined work thing, just kind of like almost every other trilogy. You could really just put
it. Okay, rather than me badly paraphrase or quote M. John Harrison, I suggest you all go listen to, it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago that they interviewed M. John Harrison, Gary and Jonathan.
I will link to that in the show notes as well, people.
Thank you. Wow, there's a lot of linking going on
there's
this episode.
A lot of linking.
So, yeah, and you can hear M. John, I'm going to call him M. John, speak, but he's not American, he's British. Well, actually, Scottish. Anyway, doesn't matter, he's not from America. Speak about it himself. Now, Light, what's it about, Kirsten?
Oh, no, it's your book. You tell us what it's about. No, well, it's a book you recommended.
Can I just read Wikipedia?
Sure.
Fuck, this
doesn't it have a blurb? You've got the actual book there.
Oh, shit, yeah, I do too.
You actually have a physical book.
I do too. Can I just say, I moved houses late last year. And I wanted to read this.
Mm.
It was in the last box I opened.
Of course.
And it was about
it
the fifth last book I pulled out.
Of course it was. But if you'd opened that box first, it wouldn't have been there. It's Schrodinger's book.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Even this is bloody long, this back. This is quite clear that people didn't, the editors weren't sure how to describe it. Anyway, beneath the unbearable light of the Kefahuchi track, that's how I'm pronouncing it. Kefahuchi.
We'll go with that.
All right. Beneath the unbearable light of the Kefahuchi track, a huge, unpredictable ocean of radiant energy deep in the galaxy, three objects lie on the barren surface of an asteroid, an abandoned spacecraft, a pair of what look like bone dice, and a human skeleton. What they are and what they mean are the mystery.
Okay, I'm just going to stop you right there because that's a really stupid blurb.
I know.
That's like chapter penultimate.
Yeah.
My goodness me.
Well, thank God this is a spoiler podcast.
Let's go to Wikipedia instead.
No, that's just a big overview. That's massive.
Fine. The book centres on the life of three individuals, the physicist and serial killer Michael Kearney, on the verge of a breakthrough in theoretical physics sometime in 1999. Saria Margenlicka, the cybernetically altered female pilot of a K-ship, which is a faster-than-light ship, and the ex-space pilot and adventurer Ed Chianese. Sierra Mao and Ed's stories take place in the year 2400 AD. And so these are your three through lines, and they're interlinked. The chapters are alternated throughout the novel.
Yep. So Michael, Ed and Sal.
Yeah, so you're following Kearney as he goes through his life and accidentally kind of discovers quantum mechanics.
Well, he's already in the midst of it. You know what? Can I just say?
Yeah.
Did they actually discover anything, Tate and Kearney? Because Tate goes insane.
They accidentally let something loose.
Oh, and that's why Tate's gone insane, because he's let something loose. Yep. And it's something to do with cats.
That the cat could see and the humans couldn't, because cats are quantum.
Yeah. Schrodinger wasn't just...
Cats are quantum beings.
Schrodinger wasn't just playing around there. He knew that cats...
Oh, look, there's a reason there are cats in this story and not, I don't know, Pekingese.
Yeah.
And then you have Saria Mao and Ed, who are 400-odd years in the future, having, you know, with society having built upon the discoveries of Kearney Tate to build quantum machines and faster-than-light travel and explore far reaches of the
Although universe. There is that wonderful bit, which is, and there are some magnificent bits in this, as much as we might pile on it a little bit at some points in this
podcast. Oh, no, there's some really great writing.
Not right, but just this wonderful bit that alien civilizations that had gone out into space had all... use star drives, etc., but all based on different technologies, some which were mutually contradictory. I mean, actually, from a physics point of view, actually contradicted each other.
Yeah.
Which I found amazing. Yeah. This idea that the physics
of the universe
is so fluid.
It is more about, I guess, collapsing possibilities down in your little corner of the universe.
Yeah, down to one particular thing that works
but
for you.
But in another corner of the universe, you've collapsed those possibilities down into something else.
Yeah, it's just
and
that...
And the Kefahuchi tract sort of is a place where everything can kind of exist because it's it's described as a singularity without an event horizon.
Correct.
So there's nothing.
I just Star Trek'd it. I just imagine one of those Star Trek anomalies, but times by a bazillion, because it's huge. It's massive. The Cavahoochee Tract.
So. And it's like.
But it's also water. It's essentially like water or foamy.
Well, it's like a coral reef space. So everything is sort of crashed on it, and there's broken ships and broken technology.
And some people have actually gone to have a look at it.
There are people who are beachcombing, and there are pirates. So it's this ocean metaphor that kind of runs through the book.
Yes. Okay. It has lots of ideas. These ideas captured the imagination of readers back in 2002 mm-hmm. and are still capturing the imagination of readers because Empty Space has only just been released. Well, it was released a year or so ago, but it got released recently in America. So it excites a lot of people. It's also because it was M. John Harrison's return to, I suppose, hard SF.
Oh, what sort of space opera?
Well, it's
space opera.
Yeah, okay, but there is that. I mean, it's hard SF as well to a degree. Although you could argue with the whole quantum thing that plays on the boundaries because it's made up science.
Yeah, exactly.
To a degree. So it was seen as M. John Harrison's come back and he's rejuvenated a flagging.
Genre?
Yeah, thank you.
he was one of the I haven't read any.
He was part of New Wave.
But he was one of the New Wave writers, and that's his right. Viconium series,
which I haven't read.
No, this is the first Harrison book I've read.
And the Centauri Device, which is the other one that he wrote during the New Wave.
So they're kind of, I guess, canon. Do we use that word?
well, that was the thing. Yes, they are Viconium, and I haven't read it, and I probably never will. Maybe I will. Don't know. Definitely a canon. If you talk to anyone serious about the genre, yes. Mm. Going by the reviews written in 2002, and we are talking about the reviews for a reason because we're going to probably focus them on as well as much as the book, is
everyone got really
is
excited.
Canon. The light and then the three books as part of the series should be canonized. They are the next big thing. And I suppose, look, I didn't read this having – got involved in the hype. I hadn't read up all these reviews and then decided to read it. It's just that, again, Gary and Jonathan, who I've now mentioned 8 times on the podcast, free advertising. Gary has been mentioning Empty Spaces quite a bit on Coon mm-hmm. Street because of its re-release, and that got me thinking, well, shit, I might give Light a go. And reading it, I thought, yeah, I can see why this excited people, but fuck, there are real major problems with this book.
You know what's funny?
And no one has really raised any of them. They might have, but not in the normal.
Not in 2002, they didn't.
No.
You know what's really funny? I had, this is an anecdotal story. I bought Light. It was thrust upon me by Justin Aykroyd of Slow Glass Books.
As he does,
back when it first came out. And I had the edition you've got there in that silver.
Yes. Silver, yep.
Silvery edition, and it was sitting on my shelf years and years and years and years and years, and I culled it about a year ago.
Thinking you'll never read it.
I'm thinking, I'm never going to – it's like 10 years now. I've sort of flicked it open and read the first chapter and went, I'm never going to read this, and I culled it, and then you said, I'm going to recommend Light. I was like, no, I just abandoned that book.
So you had to buy it, now recull it.
Well, I got an e-copy, so.
Oh, okay. Well, that was smart.
Yeah. Kind of got to say, culling, not a mistake.
Okay, we've spoken around in circles here. We've told you what it's about. It was very popular, although don't believe it was on any particular ballots. Did win the James Tiptree,
won the James Tiptree.
And was nominated for the BSFA.
Who won the James
Tiptree? With John Kessel. Got on the BSFA.
Interesting year that year. Got on the Arthur C. Clarke ballot, did it? Oh, I can't remember. But no.
It's BSFA and I think the Arthur.
I think the Tiptree's the only award it won,
yes.
Which is interesting.
Yes. So what you've got here, and the thing that first struck me as a problem, again, some beautiful writing in this, some gorgeous writing, some amazing ideas. But you've got Michael Keaney, our first – he's our – 1999 person. There's a couple of little jokes here about, just in my mind about, things have moved on a bit since Michael's time. But anyway, here's our first person.
But I mean, it's set clearly in 1999.
Yeah, yeah,
you have
absolutely.
People talking about what they're going to do on the first day of the millennium kind of thing.
Correct. And we find out pretty quickly that he's a serial killer. I don't have a problem with that. That's great. Makes him unlikable, but that's all right. That's the story. My big issue was...
I don't think the book wants him to be unlikable though, do you?
I wasn't clear. I think... Harrison is interested in complex characters. I think making someone a serial killer doesn't necessarily make them complex. He's definitely a twisted human being. My biggest problem was, okay, he's a serial killer, fine. And it's nice that Harrison doesn't actually really follow him doing his serial killing. It's just something we're told. No,
they're like an adjunct activity. It's his hobby he does.
But the reason he's a serial killer,
when he gets a bit stressed.
The reason he's a serial killer is because he keeps getting these visions of a horse skull called the Schrander.
I did a bit of my famous research, which was really interesting.
And?
The Schrander, this manifestation of the Schrander.
That he keeps saying?
Yeah, is very evidently based on a Welsh Christmas tradition of the Murray. I'm sorry, my Welsh is terrible, but here's my best attempt at pronunciation. Murray Lude. Which was, I printed out a picture for you to have a look at.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'll put on the website is what I'll do. I'll put that
okay,
on the
if
website
I saw
too.
That peering all the time on pause. Now that explains a lot, but
it's a good luck thing. So what they still do, it's still a tradition in Wales or in parts of Wales. And you'd have a horse skull on a sort of a broomstick or a stick that you held, and you had a big sort of veily sheet thing which ran off the back of it that hid the person underneath who was holding it, and there were ribbons running off the skull, and it's a good luck thing. It sort of led a group of wassailers, singers, who would go around to people's doors and sing, and it was good luck if you let them into your house and fed them and gave them drink. So it's a good luck tradition tied with Yule. So it's not actually a scary tradition at all. And the name Murray Lude translates to Grey Mare. So in English, it's often the Grey Mary thing as well.
Okay.
Just interesting. So that's obviously where he's got this imagery from, or where Michael Kearney's got the imagery from, because the Schrander appears in different ways
as an old woman and things like that. But anyway, the Schrander is there. He feels
But don't you find this interesting, that this character, which is so sinister in this book, or at least to Michael Kearney, is actually modelled from a tradition which is actually all about hospitality and good luck and singing.
And maybe there's a theme going on there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he just liked the imagery, because I can't fit what the Murray Lude actually
is in with
mine.
Or maybe saying that the Welsh are fucked if they think a horse head should.
I'm so sorry, Welsh people.
I don't know. I'm just saying that. John Harrison thinks that. He's gone and taken one of your cultural artefacts and turned it into a symbol for a serial killer. You know, I mean, you tell me who's wrong here, ain't me. But who's making the commentary? Not Ian Mond.
I really like that it's all based on Kearney's misinterpretation of the Schrander, because the Schrander's actually not sinister.
Yeah, okay.
He just wants his dice
back. Can I get to my major point, which is the Schrander is the reason why he kills. On the idea that the killing of these women, it's always women, isn't it?
Not always.
I think
they kill one effeminate, presumably gay boy.
Okay, gay men or women?
Yes.
Is that it makes the visions go away?
Yes.
Except it doesn't, because they keep coming back. So he keeps doing it. So you've got.
But that's what it is. Like temporarily, it.
Serial killers think. It felt so thin. And then you say yourself, we're meant to like this bloke. We're meant to sympathise with him.
I don't think we are meant to sympathise
with him on some level.
Yeah.
I mean, we're spending, a third of the book with him, so we're going to sympathise him on some level and at least understand why he's not helping Tate out, why he's getting so obsessed, and why he's such an arsehole to Anna. You know, we're meant to at least get that feel. But I lost him.
I don't know.
I think we need to talk about it as well, because she is one of the main characters in Empty Spaces.
Yes. Is she?
Yes. Yes, and I dare say that potentially redeems the way she's characterised in this book. But again, we're going by what this book says. I just thought, why did you think that killing people would make what? He's obviously fucked in the head.
He's a psychopath.
Yeah,
so he is fucked in the head. I mean, the other person he kills is the corporate head of their division, who's wanting to sell them to Sony, and he kills him because he doesn't want their scientific work being sold, and he just kills him, like bang, like Patrick Bateman, you know, you're in my way, I'll kill you kind of thing. So his ritual killings are all very much the killing of women and one effeminate man, who's killed because he's effeminate, by the way. It's not just like happen to be walking past. They stalk him because they see him. And
it's just you're using the serial killer cliche, and it is what that is exactly what it is.
It is. It is.
And he hasn't even dressed it up in any interest. In a novel that has so many interesting ideas, when there's such an overt cliche there, you either think there's some sort of meta going on here.
I don't know how long he took to write Light, but he would have started not long after Patrick Bateman was in American Psycho.
Mm.
And I do wonder if there's not a slight – because the matter of fact – not the explicitness of American Psycho, clearly, but the matter of factness of the way Keeney conducts his activities and his psychological lack of control, which drives him to do that, is quite reminiscent of Patrick Bateman in American Psycho. And I mean, I don't know. I didn't research that, but I wonder if, because it was a huge book when it came out.
I wanted to understand Keeney. I wanted to understand, and I don't mean that, you know, John Harrison should have just given me spoon fed me. I wanted to understand him
This is really interesting, because what would have made you understand? Like, could you understand?
He's a scientist who knows.
Yep.
You know, you do a hypothesis, you test it out. If it doesn't work, then you move on to something else.
Yeah.
The thing keeps appearing. The Schrander keeps appearing. In fact, now more regularly than prior. So killing women ain't working, mate.
But it doesn't get his. But that's the pathology of a lot of serial killers. They don't have Schranders. Also, some do. Some have people following them around. Apparently. But they have the urges which build up and build up and build up, and they kill someone and satisfy that urge,
yeah, okay.
And it goes away for a little while.
So I've missed the point.
But it comes back.
I've missed the point.
And often they
this
have
man's
to
a psych-
escalate
this man's
their
a psychopath
killings.
Who also happens to be a quantum physicist.
That's actually how I would have preferred
it. And it just so happens that the thing that for your average serial killer is actually part of their paranoia slash psychopathy, in his case, actually exists. So the Schrander is real. It's
yeah. I find it
it's a genuine thing.
I found it really telling that in all of the reviews, and including that Wikipedia entry that I printed out for you, the serial killer part of Michael Keeney is always the adjunct. Like in Wikipedia, it's in brackets. In all these reviews, like Michael Keeney, physicist, and serial killer. We actually don't see him do any physics work. We see him do a lot of killing. He's Michael Keeney, serial killer.
An avoider of
who does
doing
a little
work.
Bit of physics.
Who avoids
like,
a lot of
that. His actually primary thing is the killing.
Yeah.
And
thinks
yet
about
all
the
of the reviews,
with
all
Anna,
of the descriptions
the book,
of the book, that's all. He almost kills Anna, exactly,
yeah, I know.
Right? It's only that she wakes up
yeah.
that he doesn't kill her. But that's it. All of the reviews, all of the descriptions of the character. Some of the reviews don't even mention the serial killer part. It's like, oh, he's a scientist with a dark secret. He's a serial killer, does a bit of physics on the side. Sorry. That's all we see him do in this book. That's it. Brian Tate's a physicist who does all the freaking work.
Who keeps ringing him and then goes
yeah,
insane.
Right.
Yeah.
Michael Keeney is a serial killer.
So what were your major problems? I haven't finished, but my first major problem's been, you know, smacked on the head. So
you don't –
No, I understand. No, I've misread it.
I don't think he's a great character. I don't think he's been.
I think there's a cliche here that's
really
that,
well
that
drawn.
I, wanted...
I do. I think it's a very superficial sketch of someone who actually is a serial killer.
Yeah. Okay.
So I probably have the same problem with Michael Keeney. That
I had
you
real
do.
Problems with Saria Mao as well.
Yeah.
One of our only point of view female
who,
characters.
Who, by the way, according to my patented research that I do, the name which I didn't get reading it. But there's lots of little like 90s references in the book.
To colognes and things like that.
Apparently it's Sarah Michelle Gellar because he's a big Buffy fan, is Harrison.
Oh.
I know. As soon as I read that, I went, of course. Because there's a Buffy reference in there too.
Yeah, there is.
Someone's watching Buffy.
But there's an overt
and even
Buffy
with that in there, I didn't get that Saria Malgenica is probably.
See, it's a coded.
She's almost always referred to.
This
by
is
her
the problem with this. It's an obviously coded book.
But you don't need to know that.
You criticise a coded book. No,
but you don't need to know that. That doesn't add to the book. That doesn't decode anything.
No,
it's just the author having fun.
This is the problem. It's a coded book. And so if you criticise a coded book, you're told, well, you just don't understand it. You've missed all the codes.
You don't need to. Okay.
You didn't break the code.
If you sat there and went, well, I think Saria Malgenica is a really stupid name and therefore I didn't like the character. A, that would be a kind of a silly thing to say anyway, but B, someone can come back and go, oh, but it was this pun on Sarah Michelle Gellar and blah, blah, blah. That's about the only legitimate criticism you can make with that. You don't, that name decodes nothing. The thing isn't a freaking parody of Buffy or a deconstruction of how young women are represented as vampire hunters / pirate K-ship pilots.
It's so anyway,
a bit of fun.
It is a bit of fun.
That's it. I just read it and went,
but I do think though that the whole coded argument is one that gets used on people who criticize a book. But anyway, let's keep going because we'll show how little we understood
anyway,
this.
So
book
what about Surya Mount?
Well, it's a great idea. I love the K-ship. The K-ship is awesome. K-ship's beautiful. I love the algorithms that are not an
original idea, but you know, a classic idea of science fiction.
Yeah, all right. But what makes it probably original is the shadow people that are these algorithms, these sort of computer AIs that don't look, who are in everything and doing everything, and their relationship with Surya. The issue is where we get, well, she's violent, so she's not likable either. She kills people. Mm-hmm. She's probably psychopathic as well, you know. She gets a bunch of people come on board her ship, archaeologists, who she just jettisons out in a spite of jealousy.
She thinks they've brought a transponder on.
There's jealousy there.
There is, but she thinks she's
because there's Mona who the sex clone. Yeah.
They're both clones.
Surya as well.
No, both Monas.
You see, I understand that. Yeah.
I think it's really interesting that Surya nominates one as an original and the other as a clone.
She kills the original but keeps the well
that
she
was accidental.
But whoever
she kept was whoever.
But there was jealousy there.
But it's not jealousy of any one person. It's jealousy of what the people have, which is the their bodies.
Yes, their bodies, which she doesn't have.
Yeah.
So from a gender point of view, our main point of view female character, I suppose you could say she has some very complex problematic, she has some very complex views on gender herself.
No, she doesn't.
Well, I think she will.
She has
does.
Very complex views on human physicality.
Which is usually wrapped up with gender.
No. Well, it's wrapped.
You're going to do me again, aren't you?
No, I'm just saying. I'm halfway to agreeing with you because
that's a plus.
I think the gender problems in this book. I'm amazed. I've never read any comment about them in reviews, but I guess they're so busy raving about how brilliant the book is and it's science fiction saving novel. I think. The big difference, because people have said in reviews that, you know, all the characters are unlikable because they all kill people.
Yeah, which I don't have a problem with.
And that's a really, but to say that they're all unlikable because they all kill people and to decide that they all kill people is an equal thing is completely wrong. They all kill people in different ways for different motivations and different reasons. I mean, Ed Chinese only kills someone in self-defense.
Yes, and he's possibly the most likable person in the book, although he's a bit of he's a bit flat as a character for me.
Yeah.
But anyway, keep going. We'll spell out my gender problem then, my gender
Surya
issue problem.
Surya Mao kills people at the beginning. We see her blowing up a ship in the Kefahachi Tract.
Full of civilians.
Full of civilians. But she's being paid to do that.
Yeah.
She's a gun for hire. And when she ejects the archaeologist she took on board, she's doing it partially out of spite and partially because she genuinely thinks they brought a transponder on board.
I think the other ship that's following. I think that's very much a secondary thing.
I think it is secondary, but I think it's a genuine concern.
The spite thing, I think, is played
I think
up
that's
by M. John Harrison a lot.
That's
more.
The most thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely, she's doing it out of
that's the mostest thing in the book is the mostest. Yeah, keep going.
I just left a word out there. I was going to say the most.
But the whole characterization of the clone Mona,
yeah,
is I don't like using the word problematic because it's used a lot. But from a gender point of view, it seems a bit of a concern.
Well, the that's a wider thing in the book and
the way Anna's treated, which
the issue. Well. So he. Anyway,
oh, yeah, sorry. Let me please tease it out.
So Surya is. So Ed Chinese kills people out of self-defense.
Yes,
and he only does it once.
Well, he's only when he's escaping.
Who tried to kill him?
Yeah, several times.
So to equate him with Michael and Surya Mao and say, "Well, they all kill people. They're all unlikable," is really disingenuous. Surya Mao kills people. Because she's paid to. She's a she's run away with her K-ship, or but the K-ship has run away with her.
But has no problems with it.
No guilt. But it's her job, right?
Yeah.
And she also, importantly, I think really important for her character, what's really interesting on – like genuinely interesting is that all her killing is done remotely. She has a body, but she doesn't directly inhabit that body. She's hooked up to the ship. So
I got the feeling she was in a pod, and she's basically
she's in a tank.
She's in a shrunken wizened.
She's in it, like, and her body has been.
But there is no. She has an actual body.
She does,
but it is shrunken.
But
wizened
she doesn't identify with her body.
No, because she has avatars.
Right? Yeah. Fetches, which is really cool. Fetch is a great word because it means a spirit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when she's killing people, she's doing it remotely. Doing it via her ship. She's getting people sucked out of airlocks. She's shooting. I mean, she's not hands on.
Yeah.
She can't be hands on, right? And it's a step removed, and which, I mean, that's not to say she doesn't have a dissociative pathology, which she clearly does.
And then Michael Keaney is just a cold, hard psychopath.
Michael Keaney is a misogynistic serial killer.
Yeah.
Saria Mao's killings, she doesn't care about their gender. She doesn't care. She A, got a job to do. B, she's got to get these people off a spaceship because she's sick of the sight of their bodies and their fucking. She doesn't target the women or target the men. She's just getting them off her ship. She's just she's just destroying that other ship that she got paid to do.
Yeah,
she actually doesn't care.
So where are the gender issues then? One, the James Tiptree.
Whereas Michael Keaney
is
very much killing women.
Yeah.
That said, so they're the three differences. So I don't think you can conflate those characters and say they're all
unlikable.
And I
wasn't.
No, but other reviewers have said.
Okay.
But the problem is that you've got this book is, even though it's told and revolves around these three characters, the voice of the book is belongs to none of them. This book has a very distinct voice, which is the author's voice.
Yes, fair point.
So you're not just inside the head of a character with their thoughts and their opinions and their points of view. Therefore, you very much bring in an omniscient. It's quite omniscient in this book. The author knows exactly what. Or the teller knows exactly what's happening and has happened and will happen and lets you know about that. He knows about history. He knows about the future. He knows about all this stuff. He knows about stuff the characters he's writing about would have no idea about,
yeah.
Right? So you, all of this comes in. So you've got this overarching voice of the book, which is your point of knowledge, and he gives you information all the time about stuff. So you can't pin the language outside of direct thought and dialogue onto any one character. And in fact, the language throughout all three character streams is the same.
Except for the odd neologism.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't, the voice of the book doesn't change. You don't switch to a different tone or style with a different character. It's the book's voice. It's the book telling you the story.
Yeah, okay.
So the problem is that you just have these patterns which run through all three narratives. One of the, I guess, the easiest one to point to when you're talking about how women are represented is you all of the female characters in the book are talked about at certain points in animalistic metaphor. They're described as words like that connote, well, I mean, Annie Glyph, the girl who pulls the rickshaw, is described explicitly in terms of a horse.
Yeah.
Anna is described in dog metaphors a lot. So is Annie, actually. So is Nina, the wife of the new man.
Yep.
Which, that's a whole new thing. They're animal metaphors. The words that are being men aren't
and therefore debasing.
Men are not
and therefore
described
debasing.
That. Well, it's a linguistic history that is present in English that subservient animals, for want of a better word, so domesticated animals, animals that are beasts of burden or farming, will be linked to women. Like there's this history. It's like the word cultish. If you say someone has cultish legs, girl or boy?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Right. This is the thing. There's this one of the scenes where.
So I didn't pick that up.
Yeah.
So I didn't pick that up.
And
at all,
the only.
Possibly because I'm, part of the problem, but.
The only female character who is described still in an animalistic metaphor, but but one which is like a jungle cat, so a predator animal, is Sandra Shen, who actually we find out isn't a female anyway. Yeah. She's, you know.
And what about Anna herself?
So all of the actual women.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, which is a real problem with the language, because none of the male characters, even the more passive male characters, are ever described in those ways. And the women also, every single
aren't
one
you drawing
of them,
a okay, all right, fine, all right. Isn't that drawing a long bow though?
No, it's not. It's clear in the language of the book.
Okay.
And if this is the language you use to describe female characters, especially when you're describing sexual.
I didn't expect you to be this clever. I thought you'd
how long
out,
have we been doing this podcast?
No, true. I thought you'd pick out the fact that Anna herself is.
See, if it was just Anna, you could put it down to maybe Michael Keaney's view of her. Except it's not.
No, it's not. And she is such a dependent. She's dependent on Michael. She's obsessed with him. She's twisted. She's
yeah. And look, I really like
vicious,
Anna.
I couldn't.
Think Anna's a fantastic.
It felt like a
character.
Vicious characterization of a person who may or may not be actually based on a real person.
I think it is a vicious characterization, but I really liked her. I think the Anna who's there under the words which are used to describe it, I think she's wonderful. And if she's in Empty Space and I don't have to read Nova Swing, I might be tempted to go to Empty Space and just see what she's doing. But there's that scene in the bathtub with Anna and Michael, and she's described as panting and presenting herself. I mean, these are dog show metaphors. These are... Yeah,
see,
really
I may not
problematic
have,
language.
See, I may not have picked up the actual words themselves or language, but that did get – that got into me.
Yeah.
And I just thought this is such a vicious, disempowering, with no redeeming feature characterization of a person.
And it,
you're leaving her with nothing. You're leaving her with
– because the language is really debasing.
But no man in the book goes through such a
– Exactly. This, if it was only Anna, you could say that's because she's Michael Keaney's wife.
And Saria Mao literally has been ripped
All of the female characters, including Annie Glyph, who is wonderful and strong and powerful.
But she's still subservient to Ed because she
– Well, she – every single one of these female characters have a relationship to their body and their physicality that is entirely dependent on how men see their body sexually.
Yes.
Annie, who has been physically augmented because she pulls rickshaws.
Yes.
So she's bigger and taller and her thighs are big and, she pulls rickshaws. She's constantly asking Ed, am I small enough for you? Don't you wish I was smaller?
Yes.
And she eventually actually gets herself augmented to be a Mona clone because that's like the,
Yes. Well, can I just read what James Tiptree or judges said in 2002?
You can.
They said, and I hope we've made it clear what our arguments are at the moment. Some of you are very angry with us because some of you really love this book. Light is a stunning work that's part space opera and part something else. Some of us found the protagonist, a physicist and serial killer, your adjunct, a mass-murdering pirate, a VR addict. I'm not sure she's a pirate per se, but anyway.
Well, she's stolen a ship and she's a gun for hire.
Right.
So yeah.
Pirate will work. Mercenary, maybe. VR addict to be unlikable. Mm. Others found them brutal, cruel, self-deluded and completely real. People about whom we care deeply. And that's I find slightly this completely real thing, especially in regards to Anna, to be a little bit problematic.
Anyway, well, they may be talking about the main three characters.
I don't see how Ed can be completely real. But anyway, all the characters are shaped in ways that are very specifically have to do with the structuring and exploration of gender. The male characters are in love with ostentatious masculinity as a thing that's sometimes joyful and sometimes horrifying. The female characters are often consumed with fierce denial of their bodies, which is what you said, and their own femaleness, also what you said. Hanging over all this is the enigmatic figure of the Schrander, whose gender identity, like so much else, is ambiguous and complicated. Light is rich, horrible, sad and absurd and says a lot about how the body and sex inform one's humanity. It will reward rereading. So they've actually picked out the same issues you've picked out, but you've picked them out as a criticism of the book. They've picked it out as the strength of the book,
I
find fascinating.
I think the book doesn't really interrogate any of that. I mean, maybe it does in the later two
They didn't know that in 2002.
No, exactly. But this is the thing. I felt really trapped in this book, but it's the best word I can use to kind of describe reading it. Because I did, I felt as someone who is inhabiting a female body and a female psychology, I just felt incredibly trapped because all of the female characters in this book are trapped, and they're trapped by bodies that they don't like, or have even completely divorced themselves from. When Annie became Mona, it was just horrible. And the thing is, this
But it's not that you're looking for the bright side of this. You're looking for at least some sort of commentary on the part of the omniscient narrator who's running the show of this novel.
Yeah, and I mean, look, Saria Mao's story ends with, again, if you contrast her and Ed, and you have to because of their relationship,
yes, which
you find out, and you know, they both escape, but Ed's escape is,
His escape is genuinely liberating, and in fact, it's this idea of japes and adventures. I mean,
yeah, exactly, and it's a really active thing. Yeah. And whereas Saria's, she's completely infantilized, and I do not buy that because she
got completely reactive. Even when she ejects people, she's being reactive.
Yeah, but the thing is, I don't buy the argument. I haven't read the argument. I imagine it would be there that because she is bonded to her K-ship when she's like about 13, 14,
yeah.
That therefore she remains completely, because she's not. She develops. I don't buy that you need a body to actually develop psychologically. But she's completely infantilized. The whole time through the book she has tantrums. The ship's mathematics has to constantly put her down for a nap.
Yes.
Because she gets a bit tired and teary.
Well, don't they instantiate as a female, sort of an older female to calm her down? Isn't that?
The shadow operators.
The algorithms, yeah, the shadow operators.
I'm talking about the ship's mathematics, runs.
Oh, okay, sorry.
The thing that's always referred to as the mathematics.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
So it constantly has to, like, literally put her down for a nap.
Yeah.
And the only way that she's actually ends up getting liberated from where she is at the moment, which she has come to feel as enslaving, and she regrets not having a body or her body. In fact, there's a line that says she's deeply ashamed of what had been done to her body, which is kind of like a truth line of the whole novel. I read that and highlighted and went, yep, there we go. She's forcibly extracted from the ship by the Strander, who in her case takes a male persona, and forcibly changed into something else, which is described as frail and sent off. Whereas Ed gets to take control of a ship and off adventures and fun.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is not, as I said, if stuff was just in one stream of the book, that's fine. That's talking about that stream. And I like Anna. I hate how she's treated by Michael and by the voice of the book, but I like her.
So I don't know how you can like her given what you're a much braver and more insightful reader than I am.
I think because she's treated so cruelly, I think the sympathy is genuinely there. So you
just feel
sorry for
her, but then that's just pity, isn't it?
It's not pity.
Yeah, it's pity.
No, it's sympathy, which is not pity.
Sympathy. We'll disagree to disagree on that one, but look, there's a lot to speak about. I mean, the fact that we actually – I mean, how long – God, have we been speaking about this one book? The reviews are interesting, very, very, very ebullient about it. The Ian Banks one, and, you know, sadly departed Ian Banks, wrote a very interesting review on The Guardian. You've got Jeff Vandermeer, you've got Adam Roberts. I mean, many people have written reviews about this book. I did want you to point out, though – so one of the things that's said about the book is that, you know, there is a density to it, and, you know, there is, as I said before, that it's coded, and there are things that we may not understand or not, but that's part of the fun and the greatness of it and all that. And
I actually didn't find it a really dense book. I found the writing really playful and exuberant, which is actually kind of a problem because I didn't like the playful exuberance when you're talking about, well, we're doing a lot of the stuff he was talking about. I didn't like the playful exuberance talking about Saria Mao.
But there is a line that Jeff Vandermeer himself says that Harrison sort of went off to become a writer of literature, and he's brought those that literature styling to this science fiction novel, and so it feels very literate, very lyrical.
Yeah.
Better sentences. He's right. There is some beautiful writing
here.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Which possibly adds to the density that you say doesn't exist, but I say possibly does.
I guess there's a density
there are depths to this book. I mean, we've just spent the last...
Okay, you're not meaning like prose density.
No, I mean, sorry. Maybe I'm using the wrong word. I often do.
I thought you were talking about the density of the prose.
No. I mean more in terms
like
of...
layers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah, that I'd agree with.
So the complexity of light, we've Well, we've had a crack at to a degree.
Whereas, yeah, look, I don't mind. I mean, the complexity of it is fine. I didn't. I think it. It is,
I don't
a
mean complexity
book.
In terms of plot. I mean complexity yeah. in terms of theme and I still find it interesting that what the Tiptree judges said.
Yeah.
This is my lasting. If I have a lasting comment on this, you can ignore everything else. But the lasting thing is that the Tiptree judges have picked the same issues that you have picked, and yet have come out completely different. They've given the thing an award.
I know.
Whereas you've said there's no. Yes, those things are there. Those things are bad because for these reasons, and the book doesn't interrogate or comment. There's no commentary on
or shift away from them. I mean,
are we arguing here that women have real problems with their own physicality generally?
Yeah.
If every woman in this book has it, is that a general comment on femalehood?
And men don't.
Yes.
Apparently, men are fine. You don't have Ed Chenies, who's a very, he's a passive character to start with, so much so that he has to get his active self out in VR. And he's quite a self-conscious character to start with in terms of how he interacts with the world. Wouldn't he be wondering why Anyglyph's so taken with him?
Yep.
He never does. He's just too busy comforting her about not being too big.
Yeah,
is the thing. It's
I'm going to read. I'm going to read Nova Swing, and I'm going to definitely read Empty. And I'm probably going to read them this year. Empty Spaces, because I recommended this book because I knew it was interesting because it does leave. It's left an impression on me. Again, it's funny the things that Adam. I keep thinking of Adam as Adam Robots because of his collection. Adam Roberts says, I actually thought that was a very good review of the book because
it is a good review.
It does pinpoint the issues that I had with it,
And yet says that. They're not issues.
Yeah, whereas I thought I still think they are issues and sketchy characters, things like that. And things you've said, which I hadn't thought of, which are, you know, such as the animal references.
Well, the language is a problem all the way through. I mean, you've got Surya Mao who, she's described as literally having tantrums. She shrieks. She doesn't shout or yell or command. She shrieks all the time. The only male character who ever shrieks is, I think it was Ed Chenies.
What, you did a bloody word search on this book, did you?
No, these words are there. They jag at you. This is what I mean. Like female characters who, they don't yell or shout. They shriek, right? Male characters will yell or shout. And you've got Sierra Mao who is just, even to the end of her story, she is infantilized and
I understand.
Like I said, I was kind of trapped in the, and I think you've got this exuberant language around the male characters, and there's such, I guess what it is this book, even when you're supposedly addressing a female point of view to some extent, it's just so male gazy. It's not even
In spite of all that, yeah. I would still recommend this book. I understand why in 2002 it caught the imagination of certain people, and in fact still has, because there is something to it. There is that layer to it. It isn't all surface. There are layers.
Oh no, there are.
But I agree with you that the from a gender perspective, the commentary is poor.
I just found the writer who's obviously so careful with language and has such a command of
language. Listen to the interview with Jonathan and Gary, because he does talk about, I mean, that's why I think Anna is based on an actual person. He talks about the sort of characters he likes to write, and I think that gave me a bit more clarity in terms of this book. It doesn't necessarily forgive it for the sins that it commits, but all that said, because we're going over time, and I've got another podcast to do after this, I'd be interested. I mean, we don't get a lot of comments on the podcast, but I'd be interested to hear what people think about our thoughts on Light. As I said, I will read Nova Swing and Empty Spaces, and at some point report back because I won't recommend those books simply because we can't just do it on Amazon for the next 6 months. I dare say you won't be reading either of them.
I'm slightly interested in Empty Space because. If the Anna character
is it Empty Space or Empty Spaces? It probably is Empty Space.
Empty Spaces. Yeah. If she's a major character in that one, I'd be slightly interested to see where she's at and what she's doing. I don't know. When you have an omniscient voice, I mean, the voice of the book is very male. It's very male. It doesn't describe the male characters in the same way it describes the female characters. This is not a genderless omniscient voice, which it should be if you equate that voice to the Shrander, which you probably should, because when you get to the end and you get the whole story, the voice of the book which knows everything and is telling everything, actually should be the Shrander, who is gender neutral, who's not even human. Who, I mean, gender wouldn't even factor into them except when it needs to present itself to someone. And to have a book which is so thoroughly male-gazy, it's, as I said, reading it, it's not that I look for these things, it's that they jag on me. And I you know, the ideas and that, the, all the science, the Kefauhachi tract, all of that is wonderful, but there's this bitter aftertaste as I'm reading it, I can't enjoy
it. If reading recent internet discussions has had any effect on me, and I think of people like Jim Hines and others, a character like Michael Kearney, where the character arc, the character involvement is because of the things that he does to women, that's just not good enough.
I just think he's a really shallow. I mean, he's not even a good character
It's the old. Oh, my girlfriend got raped. I have to take revenge on her. That's the character development I'm going to have. In this case, it's even worse. I'm a serial killer, and I treat my once ex-wife, whatever, like absolute shit. That's my character development, and you went to sympathise with me, and that's where the problem, real problematic for me. I don't like using the word problematic, but that's. Anyway,
I think, funnily enough, I just have a bigger problem with the entire feel of the book. It's interesting. You have a look at the back of your book that you've got there, and all of the glowing quotes, like in the back pages. It's filled with glowing quotes, and some of them are from they're just given the name of the publication that they appeared in. But more than half of them are actually from they give the name of the person who said it, and they're all male names.
Well, they're all men. Yep.
And most of the reviews, the ones I could find, were written by men as well. And this is what it feels like. This is what it feels like. This feels like the book that boys want science fiction to be. It's the book that pushes the girls away and says, "This isn't for you." It's a great book. It's the best book of the year. It's going to bring back science fiction. Not for you, ladies. Not for you. That's the feel of this book for me.
All right.
Other people who read it, other women who read it. I'm not saying every woman is going to feel the same way, but that was the feel of it. And as much as I really liked the ideas and loved all the sort of quantum stuff, I could get that in another book, and I might not have the bitter aftertaste. That's all I got to say.
Next month. Next month.
Next month.
Do you want me to recommend? What's your episode?
It's my episode. yes, next month. You're recommending Life After Life by Kate Atkinson, which I hadn't even heard of. I when you recommended it, I looked it up online and went, "That sounds interesting." So I'm keen to read it. Don't look at me like that. Now you've made me worried. You've read it, yeah?
Yes.
All right. Now I'm worried. Because you've got that look that says, "I don't know if Kirsten's going to appreciate this book."
Interesting book,
right?
I did debate whether I was going to do this one because I didn't want to do two books in a row, which I found quotes interesting.
Ian.
But this one in particular is actually very similar to the M. John Harrison, huge positive critical take on it.
Mm.
It's written by a mainstream. I've read Kate Atkinson before. Read Case Histories.
I haven't read
any. She's a really good mainstream writer. Mm. Now delving into a bit of genre, although that's not how the book is sold. Just let me quickly finish. Not how the book is sold, but yeah, really interesting to hear your take on it.
Okay, well that's interesting because the book I have recommended, without even knowing what you were recommending, is The Testament of Jesse Lamb by Jane Rogers, which is also literary writer. I was going to say dabbling, but that's not fair. She's a literary writer, and she's writing a book that's science fictional in its subject matter.
We're amazing, aren't we?
So we've been in sync on that. And mine was also nominated for a Booker, a Man Booker Prize.
And there was thoughts that Life After Life would be nominated.
Yeah, and I'm really interested to discuss not only the book.
It didn't get on the long list, but there's a lot of talk that it was.
Yeah, but I'm interested to discuss the book, obviously, but also some stuff around the book. So I think it'll be a really cool podcast next week, next month.
Yeah, next week. Fuck no. Probably better than this one.
Probably. No, that's not fair. And also, I think we should clarify to listeners that we don't have to recommend a book that we absolutely love and adore.
Oh no, I feel guilty because
we don't.
You remember the ebook shenanigans of 2012?
I do.
Where we piled on a whole bunch of books and it was very negative.
None of us picked those books.
I am negative by nature. I love being negative, but I understand that we need to.
I think you need to recommend a book that you can say more positive things about than not.
I can definitely do that with Life After Life.
It's okay if there's stuff you don't like about it. It's okay if you've got a problem with it. I mean, look, I would...
And I would still recommend Light.
I would recommend Light too. I would say, you know, just beware of the sort of the sensibilities of the book. It's not just all fun and games with quantum physics.
Yes. Let's not start the Light conversation.
Yeah. Anyway, so you can send us feedback by commenting at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, which is probably where you downloaded this from, unless you downloaded it from iTunes. You can email us by sending that to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter and tweet us there, and we are Writer and Critic on Twitter. And I think Ian would want me to say that also... If you downloaded this from iTunes and you liked it.
Don't say it like that. No. Don't. If you're going to say it with a happiness in your voice. We want 5-star ratings. Boom, boom.
You can leave any star rating you wish.
5-star ratings.
We'll be very sad if you only leave us 1 or 2 stars.
Well, no, if you do, can you tell us why? Because we will.
Yes, tell us why.
Because we'll radically change the podcast based on your advice.
And well, we would if everyone did it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See ya. Actually, that should be the start. Can we do this in the fucking podcast?
And my little... That might be the end.